Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Susan Shand, Dorothy Gundy, and Pete Musto. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, for years, people living in Somalia's capital of Mogadishu, wanting to watch the World Cup on television, have done so at great risk. The Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab threatened violence against anyone watching the games. The danger was especially high in 2010. The militants controlled most of Mogadishu. They searched the city for anyone trying to secretly watch the soccer games. But the 2018 World Cup has been different. So far, there have been no reported attacks on Somalis watching the games on TV in public or private. People in Mogadishu have been gathering to watch the World Cup inside hotels, restaurants, and government centers. Somalia's security ministry spokesman said the change is because of improved security. He added that there is a greater willingness of people to ignore what he calls the terrorists' psychological war. Al-Shabaab believes that sports are un-Islamic and a waste of time. Al-Shabaab militants killed two people watching a World Cup match in a movie theater in 2006. In 2010, the militant group bombed two World Cup parties in Uganda's capital, Kampala, killing more than 70 people. But an increase in the number of Somali government soldiers, African Union peacekeepers, and private guards has made Somalis feel safer about enjoying the World Cup in public. The threat of attack has not entirely ended. In April, at least 5 people were killed and 10 others injured after a bomb exploded during a soccer game in the city of Barawe. In the last 5 years, Al-Shabaab has bombed or shot up more than 20 hotels and restaurants in Mogadishu. But it is becoming harder to keep Somalis away from the country's favorite sport. High-speed internet and satellite TV have become more common in the past few years. This permits more people to watch games from the privacy of their homes. Khadija Mohamed Dirie is Somalia's Minister for Youth and Sport. She believes sports and other forms of entertainment will distract Somali youth from pursuing extremist ideologies and the deadly migration to Europe.
As a child, Timothy Twix Ward thought he was normal, but his family saw something special about him. Ward is a member of the San Carlos Apache tribe in the southwestern state, Arizona. It wasn't until I got older that I knew who I was, that I was different from everyone else, Ward said. Ward identifies not as a man or a woman, but both, and neither. Twix Ward is a two-spirit. The term was first used in Winnipeg, Canada, during a 1990 intertribal conference of Native American, First Nations, gays and lesbians. Taken from the Ojibwe language, the term was chosen to serve for all Native American people who do not fit into traditional gender roles. Two-spirited people are not LGBTQ, although some two-spirited people are LGBTQ, said Ward. Ward added that a real two-spirit is someone who understands Native American culture and traditions. Ward lives year-round in a traditional Apache house and takes part in traditional ceremonies. Ward also makes traditional clothing for ceremonies marking the change from girlhood to womanhood. I try to teach the girls what the dress is for, the meaning behind it in their ceremony, Ward said. Not everyone in the community accepts Ward, and the two-spirit admits to loneliness. Some people that claim to be traditional are upset with me because they think I'm acting like I know more than them, Ward said. Ward wears the traditional clothing and face paint markings that identify two spirits.
In South Dakota, 2,000 kilometers away, Kelly Bingen identifies as a two-spirit bisexual. Born on the Lower Brule Reservation, she now lives in the city of Sioux Falls. Two-spirits are people who can balance both their male and their female sides, she said. Dad taught us girls to do anything that a man can do. But she said she still has a girl side. I can wear a dress, put makeup on, and go out. Like Ward, Bingen believes only natives who understand their traditions can claim two-spirit identity. The two-spirit does not believe the term should ever be used to describe non-natives. New York City musician and activist Tony Enos presents a different understanding of two-spirit. Enos was raised in a racially mixed family in Pennsylvania. He identifies as two-spirit because of his father's Cherokee ancestors. Before colonization, we were balance keepers. We were the only ones that could move between the men's and women's camps. There was a special role for this blessing, to be able to see life through male and female eyes. And that's what the Two-Spirit movement is all about, he said, reclaiming the special position Two-Spirits held in pre-colonial tribal communities. But is that even possible?
Much of what is known about historic Two-Spirits comes from books written by Western missionaries and ethnographers. Those writers called Two-Spirits by the insulting word burdash, an Arabic word for slave boys. In some tribes, Two-Spirits were honored as healers, seers, and name givers. Two-spirits of the Yokut and Mono peoples of California were diggers of burial places. They were believed to be guided by the dead. I'm Susan Shand.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Hundreds of amateur citizen scientists have begun studying the Pacific Northwest area of the United States. They are seeking to learn more about the nearly 30 species of bumblebees that live there. Bumblebees are important for the growth of wild and agricultural plants. They help spread the substances that make it possible for flowers to reproduce through the process known as pollination. But some bumblebee species have disappeared from the places where they were once common. The new 3-year-long research effort is known as the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas Project. Organizations in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington are working together as part of it. Researchers hope to collect enough information to suggest ways to protect bumblebees and their habitat. Ann Potter works with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. She told the Associated Press it is important for humans to study honeybees, the little guys that make the world go around. Rich Hatfield works with the conservation group the Xerces Society. He noted that there is growing interest in returning the habitats for pollinators to their earlier, healthier conditions. The project's leadership is sending citizen scientists to selected 1-hectare sites. They will have tools to capture insects, as well as plant and bee guides. The amateur researchers will also have a special application, or app, on their smartphones. The app makes it so that findings can be recorded, photographed, mapped, and sent to a central database. Researchers say a little more than 200 people have agreed to visit 400 sites through the end of August. Hatfield said more volunteers are needed, especially to work in more difficult-to-reach areas. For the study, the bees are captured and put in a low-temperature container so that they go into a sleep-like state. Photos are taken that examine the condition of the bees. The bees are then released unharmed once they warm up. Unlike honeybees, bumblebees do not spend the winter living in their self-made structures known as hives. Instead, they usually spend the winter in holes in the ground. There are usually only a few hundred individual bumblebees left alive by the time fall arrives. Any honey they produce, they eat. When winter begins, all bumblebees die except a few pregnant queen bees. In the spring, those queens head out alone to start a new structure to live and produce worker bees in, beginning the process all over again. Anthony Melathopoulos is with Oregon State University. His research interest centers on this period of bumblebees' lives when they live alone. Here's a species that spends a big part of its life as a vulnerable queen, he said. Honeybees first came to the United States from Europe. People brought them in order to help with the pollination of their crops. But when it comes to native North American plants and some crops, bumblebees are much more useful. They are much stronger and can hold onto an entire flower, shaking loose the necessary substance for plant reproduction. For some plant species, the bumblebee is the only insect strong enough to do so. The western bumblebee was once considered common and widespread, but it has since disappeared from many of the areas it once lived in. And experts for the current study are hoping to find reasons for the sudden decrease in western bumblebee populations. Ross Winton of Idaho Fish and Game admitted that scientists do not know much about bumblebees. "The more we learn, the more concerned we get," he added. In the end, the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas could be an example for other states interested in learning more about how their bumblebee populations are doing. Melithopoulos said, "I think everyone is looking at the Pacific Northwest and this initiative as a test case." The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is paying for the research done in Idaho and Washington. In Oregon, another government group called the Foundation for Food and Agricultural Research is providing financial support. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Bob Doty with Steve Ember. We continue the story of the administration of Herbert Hoover, and we talk about the election of 1932.
President Herbert Hoover worked hard to rescue the American economy following the crash of the stock market. It happened in October of 1929. Within a month, Hoover called the nation's business leaders to the White House. "Don't lower wages," the president told them. Hoover called on the bankers at the Federal Reserve to make it easier for businesses to borrow money. He tried to provide funds to help farmers get fair prices for their crops. He pushed Congress to lower personal taxes. And above all, the president urged Americans not to lose hope in their economy or in themselves.
But the economy was in ruins, falling faster with each passing day of the crisis that grew into the Great Depression. The value of stocks had collapsed. Millions of workers lost their jobs. The level of industrial production in the country was less than half of what it had been before the stock market crash. Hoover's efforts were not enough to stop the growing crisis. In ever greater numbers, people called on the president to increase federal spending and provide jobs for people out of work. But the president was a conservative Republican. He did not think it was the responsibility of the federal government to provide relief for poor Americans. And he thought it was wrong to increase spending above the amount of money that the government received in taxes.
The situation seemed out of control. The nation's government and business leaders appeared to have no idea how to save the dollar and put people back to work. Hoover was willing to take steps like spending government money to help farmers buy seeds and fertilizer, but he was not willing to give wheat to unemployed workers who were hungry. He created an emergency committee to study the unemployment problem, but he would not launch government programs to create jobs. Hoover called on Americans to help their friends in need, but he resisted calls to spend federal funds for major relief programs to help the millions of Americans facing disaster.
Leaders of the Democratic Party made the most of the situation. They accused the president of not caring about the common man. They said Hoover was willing to spend money to feed starving cattle for businessmen, but not willing to feed poor children. Hoover tried to show the nation that he was dealing with the crisis. He worked with Congress to try to save the banks and to keep the dollar tied to the value of gold. He tried hard to balance the federal budget. And he told Americans that it was not the responsibility of the national government to solve all their problems.
Late in 1931, President Hoover appointed a new committee on unemployment. He named Walter Gifford to head this committee. Gifford was chief of a big company, American Telephone and Telegraph. But Gifford did Hoover more harm than good. When he appeared before Congress, Gifford was unable to defend Hoover's position that relief was the responsibility of local governments and private giving. He admitted that he did not know how many people were out of work. He did not know how many of them needed help, or how much help they needed, or how much money local governments could raise.
The situation grew worse. Some Americans began to completely lose faith in their government. They looked to groups with extreme political ideas to provide answers. Some Americans joined the Communist Party. Others helped elect state leaders with extreme political ideas. And in growing numbers, people began to turn to hatred and violence. However, most Americans remained loyal to traditional values, even as conditions grew steadily worse. They looked ahead to 1932, when they would have a chance to vote for a new president.
Leaders of the Democratic Party felt they had an excellent chance to capture the White House in the election, and their hopes increased when the Republicans renominated President Hoover and Vice President Charles Curtis in the summer of 1932. For this reason, competition was fierce for the Democratic presidential nomination. The top candidate was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the governor of New York State. Roosevelt had been re-elected to that office by a large majority just 2 years earlier. He came from a rich and famous family, but he was seen as a friend of the common man. Roosevelt was conservative in his economic thinking, but he was a progressive in his opinion that government should be active in helping people. Roosevelt had suffered from polio and could not walk. He used a wheelchair, although it was rarely shown in news pictures.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt's two main opponents were Al Smith and John Garner. Smith had been the governor of New York before Roosevelt. Garner, a Texan, was the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Together, they hoped to block Roosevelt's nomination, and they succeeded the first three times that delegates voted at the Democratic nominating convention in Chicago. Roosevelt's chief political adviser, James Farley, worked hard to find Roosevelt the votes he needed at the convention. Finally, Farley found a solution. He made a deal with supporters of John Garner. Roosevelt would make Garner the vice presidential nominee if Garner's forces voted to make Roosevelt the presidential nominee. Garner agreed. And on the next vote, the Democratic delegates nominated Franklin Roosevelt to be their presidential candidate. Al Smith was so angry about the deal that he left Chicago without congratulating Roosevelt. Roosevelt wanted to show the nation that he was the kind of man to take action, that he had more imagination than Hoover. So he broke tradition and flew to Chicago. It was the first time a candidate had ever appeared at a convention to accept a nomination. And Roosevelt told the cheering crowd that together they would defeat Hoover.
The main issue in the campaign of 1932 was the economy. President Hoover defended his policies. Roosevelt and the Democrats attacked the administration for not taking enough action. Roosevelt knew that most Americans were unhappy with the Hoover administration. So his plan during the campaign was to let Hoover defeat himself. He avoided saying anything that might make groups of voters think he was too extreme. But Roosevelt did make clear that he would move the federal government into action to help people suffering from the economic crisis. He said he was for a balanced federal budget. But he also said the government must be willing to spend extra money to prevent people from starving.
Americans liked what they heard from Franklin Roosevelt. He seemed strong. He enjoyed life. And Roosevelt seemed willing to try new ideas, to experiment with government. Hoover attacked Roosevelt bitterly during the campaign. He warned that Roosevelt and the Democrats would destroy the American system. But Americans were tired of Hoover. They thought he was too serious, too afraid of change, too friendly with business leaders instead of the working man. Most of all, they blamed Hoover for the hard times of the Depression. On Election Day, Americans voted in huge numbers for Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats. Roosevelt won 42 of the 48 states at that time. The Democrats also gained a large majority in both houses of Congress.
The election ended 12 years of Republican rule in the White House. It also marked the passing of a long conservative period in American political life. Franklin Delano Roosevelt would become one of the strongest and most progressive presidents in the nation's history. He would serve longer than any other president, changing the face of America's political and economic systems.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.